Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 219.
Who is this superhero?
Sarge?
No. Rosemary, the telephone operator? No. Henry, the mild-mannered janitor?
Could be!
This week, I am joined by St. Anthony, where we discuss a wee bit about the end of the season, the departure of Neil Lennon, and of course, the impending arrival of our new manager. St. and I managed to disagree on virtually everything, I think, as we go through the podcast. To be fair, some of it I'm not specifically disagreeing, I'm just trying to put forward what the board's counter point would be to some of the issues he raises in relation to funding, etc. So this is me, Harry Brady, and this is him, St. Anthony. I am joined now by St. Anthony, so it's not St. Anthony with a guest talking about a book, and it's not me with a guest filling in between St. Anthony's podcast. It's myself and St. Anthony. So how you doing, Saint?
I'm very well, thank you.
So last time I can't remember who was the last one to do a podcast, you or me, the season was on. The season has since finished. We have had our manager depart, and as we talk on Wednesday evening, it looks like we finally have a new manager in place, so it's all very exciting.
I have to say, I'm still in a state of shock, actually, when Lennon left, because I just couldn't see that coming. I went on holiday last week, and I started getting texts, and the first text I got, I actually thought somebody was at it, kidding on that Lennon had resigned, and then another guy sent a text, and another guy, and I thought, oh my God, something's gone down here. And I'm a wee bit at a loss as regards to the reasons of the old Lennon going, so... I don't think Celtic's made it particularly clear, and I don't think Lennon has either. But now that he's gone, we have to move on, and I have to say that the new guy, the Norwegian guy, fills me with a wee bit of optimism. My first reaction is I'm fairly optimistic.
Oh, good. Well, you say about being surprised at Lennon. Am I saying surprised? You're surprised?
Yeah, I know. Maybe in hindsight, there was indications, especially with Mialbi leaving. And I've also read that Lennon was fairly muted when they won the league, and he wasn't his normal self, possibly, during the celebrations. But I don't know. Maybe because I was a distance away, and it came as a bigger shock. And I just never gave it any thought that we were going to need a new manager before the start of the season.
I suppose my surprise that you're being surprised is also partly because I'm sure I'd said to you that I'd heard, and I know that Eddie had heard, and I thought Eddie had said, I heard a lot of things that this time last year Lennon was heavily thinking about leaving, and he was talking about it, the indications that the board themselves actually thought he wouldn't come back after the summer. This time last season, I spoke with someone tonight who tells me that Owen Coyle met with Dermot Desmond around this time last year. Now, I do know that if Lennon had left, it would have been Coyle last year. That's about the third different place that I've heard that I would... This time, it's not come from people connected with Celtic. This time, it connected someone connected with Owen Coyle who told me that this evening. So,
I mean, there's a funny thing there. There's Owen Coyle. 4 years ago, he got Burnley promoted to the Premiership. And his stock was very, very high. And we came in for him and knocked his back. And all of a sudden, he joined Bolton and they get relegated. And then he goes to Wigan and he gets the sack after a short period at Wigan. So it goes to show how, you know, maybe you only get sometimes in life you only get the one chance and you need to grab it. And I wonder if Owen Coyle, to his dying day, will regret not taking that Celtic job, because I don't see him ever getting it. No, I think he's damaged goods, Owen Coyle.
Yeah.
After getting the sack at Wigan, that's his reputation's been tarnished.
I think you're right. I think he probably will, although if he'd taken the Celtic job till he's and say things hadn't gone well at Celtic, till his dying day, would he have regretted not having a go in the English Premiership? I suppose, you know, carry on with these things. In relation to taking the Wigan job, I always remember through business speaking to Davy Moyes' brother. And this is going back a few years. So it was when Davy Moyes had just left Preston to take the Everton job. And David Moyes' brother was saying that he had been offered the Forest job and he'd also been offered the Sheffield Wednesday job while he was at Preston. And he'd knocked both of them back because what he said was, you sometimes have to look at the bigger picture of a club, and sometimes some clubs, when they leave the top flight, are in free fall. Sometimes they just... Actually, they just drop down, and if you get them at the right time, you can take them back up. But others are in free fall, and you've got to watch out that you don't take them when they're on a trajectory on the way down that virtually nobody will stop. And if you go to one of those clubs, and at that point, Forest and Wednesday were still on their way down after he'd taken them. He said, and the problem is, if you take one of those clubs and you haven't identified that they're still on their way down, you could go in. Nobody has a chance to turn it around, and you've just ruined your career.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you the reason why I'm happy about with the Norwegian guy. I'm a great believer, in, especially in the league we're in, of getting people in, whether they're players or managers, who are on the road up, and who see Celtic as a step up. You know the Roy Keane thing, if you believe the hype that it was Dermot Desmond against Peter Lawwell, and there was maybe a clash of personalities there. And the thing about Keane that I would have been a wee bit dubious about was Keane would have seen Celtic as a step up. He would have seen that as a step down coming to Scotland, especially with the way our league is at the moment, and it's fairly uncompetitive. And I don't think that would have been Keane's thing. I don't think he would have hung about for long, Roy Keane. And I think he would have been a short-term thing. He'd have certainly been given us a higher profile in England, but I would rather have the higher profile in Europe. I would rather the Norwegian guy comes in, gets a good style of play, gets us into, hopefully, through the qualifiers and into the Champions League, and then makes a wee bit more of a fist of it than we did last season.
Well, I did find it interesting because, of course, never a truer thing with all the rumours of potential Celtic managers than you can't please all of the people all of the time when you were looking on Twitter. There wasn't a single name that you didn't have some people like and some people dislike. Mm-hmm. The only difference was whether it was a greater dislike or a greater like. With Roy Keane, I did find it funny that the very people who were putting... There was not that many people who seemed to be in favour of Keane, but the very people who were saying that Keane would be a good thing were the very people who were making comments like, if we go for the cheap option of Owen Coyle, I'll not renew my season book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, their managerial records were very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Keane took over Sunderland at the bottom of the towards the bottom of the Championship, won
the initial
promotion.
Initial success.
Coyle does all right at St Johnstone, then goes to Burnley and does fantastic at Burnley to get them into the Premiership. They then leave Sunderland and Burnley. Actually, Coyle leaves Burnley to go to Bolton, to another Premiership club, and does all right at Bolton. And then things start to go... between the two of them, I would argue that Coyle has a massively better record than Keane.
What you're forgetting as well is Coyle done a really good job at St Johnstone.
Yeah.
And that's where he first came to light, is being good managerial quality. But the thing about Keane is... I admire Roy Keane tremendously. I don't particularly like him because I still bear a grudge against him, to be honest, for walking at Nairn. I'm the Mike McCarthy when it comes to that. But I do admire him as a player, but I just think he's a loose cannon, and nobody knows how he was going to react to anything. It could actually be that Roy Keane would have taken the Celtic job in June and walked out in October. He's that kind of guy.
Well, I thought, you know that way. In general, I've been a bit indifferent. Maybe sounds as though I don't care, but I've had a bit of a laissez-faire, what will be to the Celtic manager. I don't have an input into the Celtic manager's job, so there's no point in getting my knickers in a twist about who it will or it won't be. Just see who it is, and hopefully it's someone that I can get excited about and hopefully someone that's going to be do a good job. That's really what I was looking at it.
Well, I said to you from the beginning that when we were exchanging texts that I was disappointed with the initial sort of clamour for Keane, and I said I would have liked a foreign manager. The reason that I say that is that when you watch football on television, whether it's the early stages of the Champions League qualifiers or the latter stages of the Europa League, I never feel to be amazed by the football played by teams like Bale and Benfica and Sporting Lisbon and PSV Eindhoven. And these are all teams that roughly, we would regard ourselves as maybe being a bigger name than them in some way. We get bigger attendances, for example. But when you look at the background that we're playing in and the revenue that we have available to us, then we are in that bracket.
Yeah.
And when I look at the football that some of these teams play, it really excites me here and often think, how can we not play like that? So I'm really optimistic that the Norwegian guy will come in with a set way of playing and he'll get the players on side early and we'll hit the ground running. And maybe we'll see a wee bit better quality football. Although that should be interpreted as a criticism of Lennon, because I wrote a piece in the site there when I come back for the holiday that I don't think Lennon's getting the appreciation for Celtic fans he deserves. 4 years ago, I mean, it's easy to forget, we were in a terrible condition 4 years ago. And the turnaround in that space of time, it was quite remarkable. And Neil Lennon deserves a whole lot of credit for what he achieved as Celtic manager.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, when I was saying about not surprised it moved on, part of the reason why I wasn't surprised it moved on is because from various things, I'd heard that he was getting to the point of wanting to move on this time last year. And it's no surprise when, getting back to what he's achieved, he's done a fantastic job from where we were to win three titles in a row, get to the last 16 of the Champions League. But there is, the pressure must be pretty immense. And I saw you tweet something about Neil Lennon have a greater emotion for Celtic than Roy Keane. There's a part of me actually thinks that for the sanity of the manager, I would prefer a manager, particularly this time, to maybe not be a Celtic fan.
Yeah.
Because
the
pressure of being the Celtic manager at a time when you'll get criticism if you don't win the treble. Because, you've got no competition, so you should win the treble. That must be really difficult to handle every day, and you're more likely to be conscious of that if you're a Celtic fan than if you've come from elsewhere, I would have thought.
I mean, I get down to England sometimes, and I've got friends down there, and I try to explain to them that they don't appreciate the pressure that Celtic managers are put under, because if we go into the Champions League and we draw Real Madrid, Bayern Munich and Paris Saint-Germain, it sounds crazy, but we actually expect to win. You know, we still have that, as Celtic fans, we still have that fierce pride that wherever we go, you know, that we have a reputation to uphold. And it may not be a realistic thought that we're going to beat teams of that calibre, but as Celtic fans, I know that we don't go in there thinking we're going to be cannon fodder. We go in there from the beginning thinking we're going to fight our way through here and try and achieve something. But I think what will be interesting about the new manager is to see who he brings in, to see if he brings in his backroom staff from the Norwegian team, or will he opt for maybe an experienced Scottish assistant and a couple of Scottish coaches who know the background better and will be able to guide them. So that's something that I'm going to be interested to see how that pans out.
Yeah, well, maybe I was reading too much into it, but one of the only other people whose odds shortened marginally today from a real outsider into about 10-1 Celtic manager was Peter Houston. Now, I don't think he's got any chance of being a Celtic manager, but what I did wonder whether he's actually been spoken to by the club about a more senior role, and if he's, you know, if people have heard stuff to do with that, then people have misinterpreted and put money on. But when I saw that, I thought I do wonder whether if we're going for a foreign coach, then we might be looking for someone who has quite a bit of experience within the Scottish game as part of his team. You would.
That would make sense.
It would make sense.
It's a wee bit like, remember Murdoch McLeod when he came in to help Vinnie Hansen,
yeah,
and they ended up being a great wee partnership.
Yeah.
And
was Eric Black with Dr. Joe? Did he stay around after John Barnes?
I think Eric Black was. Oh, no, he stayed on under Janssen.
Right.
Did he just come under? Eric Black was there for a period under a few managers, I think he got promoted to the youth setup to be an assistant to Dr. Joe. So he did.
So we'll see how it goes. But the other reason, I suppose, for Lennon wanting to go is I do know that he was wanting a shot in the Premiership.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last 15 months, I think there's been 13 jobs in the Premiership.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not been quoted. For any of them. And I think part of that is, I think your agent has to be quite forceful. And if you're Celtic manager, you can hardly have your agent knocking on people's door saying, because that's bound to leak out.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether part of the reason why he left was he thought... part of the reason why he left was to make it easier to get a job and for his agent to be a bit more forceful.
Have Norwich appointed a new manager yet?
Yeah, they did.
Who did they get?
I think they appointed the caretaker guy on a full-time basis.
Oh, right. Well, I never knew that. So.
Because Malcolm...
Not by Southampton, did they get anybody?
No. I hear that Norwich, because Malcolm Mackay was not giving them an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Southampton haven't appointed anyone. I heard today, around about 3 o'clock today, to be precise, that Brighton were interested in Lennon.
Mm.
So, I don't know if he would go there. But
he's maybe better hanging off and taking a couple of months in it, and then, because you know what it's like, especially in the Premiership, there's always three or four teams that don't have a particularly good start, and you can just guarantee that by the time October comes, there'll be a few casualties.
Aye, yeah. And there's bound to be, well, the most common one that I keep hearing and kept hearing, which is also the other reason why, if it's as set in stone as I've been hearing for 9 months, is that the owners of Leicester don't particularly fancy Nigel Pearson.
Mm-hmm.
He's got them into the Premiership, so they can hardly fire him after he's done that. But the... will be ready to get rid of him in October, November, if they are where they expect to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've always wanted Lennon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's what I keep hearing. If Lennon's been told the same thing, well, it's a lot easier to walk into the Leicester job than it would be to walk out of Celtic if we were in the Champions League.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is good luck to him. I think, given what he suffered during his period here, between one thing and another, that and what he achieved, that then he deserves nothing but best wishes when he moves on.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the problem for Lennon has always been being at Celtic, and you might be a bit forgotten up here as well. So if he leaves and he's got an agent going and knocking on people's doors,
mm-hmm.
He's done a good job with Celtic, and we'll see what comes with him. So if we move on from Lennon for a minute, how would you sum up last season?
I would sum up last season as enjoyable in the league and frustrating in the cups. I think that the some of the stuff they played in the league was fantastic. And I really, really enjoyed it. I particularly enjoyed Chris Commons last season, who really came to the fore and showed us what a great player he is. And there were certain games in the league where we weren't playing particularly well, and then we would just click for a 20-minute period. And in that 20-minute period, we'd almost guarantee you 3 or 4 goals. It was an amazing number of games that we played where we sort of huffed and puffed, and then all of a sudden something just happened and everything clicked into gear. And last season I really enjoyed it in terms of the league, I think. We were very consistent. We put on a good standard of football. But on the downside, that when you lose at home to Morton in the League Cup and you lose at home to Aberdeen in the Scottish Cup, then they were sore ones. And the Champions League qualifier against Karagandy, but will be remembered as a long, for a long, long time for the dramatic finish. But having said that, although we were in a difficult group, I don't think we did ourselves justice. I think we were a better team than that. And we maybe let ourselves down a wee bit in that respect.
Your first point there about a game being tight and then all of a sudden scoring a goal and then we went on to win comfortably. Do you know, two games that I thought demonstrated that point, it's interesting as you say it, were right at the end of the season, the home game against Aberdeen and the away game against St Johnson. In that, the home game against Aberdeen, there was a brief period in the second half where Aberdeen sort of, you know, we made it 1-0, they made it 1-1, we made it 2-1, then we made it 3-1, then they made it 3-2. And just at that point, as they made it 3-2, they all of a sudden were in the ascendancy for 5-10 minutes, and you thought, wait a minute, they actually might. This is the first time in the game, you know, because their two goals hadn't been concerted pressure, they'd been away. And you thought, we might end up chucking away a 3-1 lead here, and they might go on to make it 3-each. Commons then scored, and it was dead easy. We made it 4-2, and you actually felt at that point we could go on and score 5, 6 and 7 if we wanted, because all of a sudden it just turned easy. And the reverse was true in the St Johnston game, the next game when we were away at McDermott Park, when we were in a pretty comfortable... 3-1 up. And then we are pretty comfortable. And then they scored quite goals. I always felt if Aberdeen had scored, it would have probably finished 3-each in that game. Instead, we won it 5-2. And there just seemed to be, as you say, tipping points in games. And then the other thing in Europe, I just felt the order of the way that the results came, it was almost as if the team themselves didn't, after three games, didn't think we were going to do anything. I thought, and actually I wasn't intending to go on this, but I thought we really suffered for the absence of Scott Brown in our Champions League group.
But then again, it's arguably people, Scott Brown, it was self-inflicted. It was another indication of how Scott Brown hasn't got over that daft streak, he hasn't matured the way that we hoped. I honestly, I was really disappointed in Scott Brown because I thought he left all that rubbish behind him. And I accept what you're saying, that his influence and his presence in the team in the corresponding games when he was suspended, we did miss him. There's no doubt about it, we did miss him. But the nonsense that he got involved in, you know, really disappointed me. I thought he'd left that behind. That said, if Scott Brown had moved on.
I actually thought that what he did was out of character.
It's the kind of thing,
and I'm not being funny here, it's the kind of thing,
if you were watching it on television and Rangers were playing and Ian Black did something like that, you would lambast him. There's no defending it and getting away from it. It was a crazy thing to do.
Well, that's what I say. It's the sort of thing, I mean, I've been reading, because I didn't know that you didn't like Scott Brown until...
This is a myth that's been perpetuated on Twitter. I do like Scott Brown, and I've got a lot of time for Scott Brown. My only concern about Scott Brown is that over the course of his contract, if he have spent $4.5 million in order to get his signature, and then they've given him $25,000 a week, which roughly, in basic maths, is something in the region of £10 million. And I just think that in this league that we're playing in, for the amount of money that we're spending, I'm looking for more than what Scott Brown brings to the table.
Yeah, but to be fair, that's not Scott Brown's fault.
No, it certainly isn't.
No, so my point, to that extent...
Do you think overall that Scott Brown has been valued for money since he signed for Celtic?
No, but I wouldn't couch it that way. Is Scott Brown the most expensive player in our team?
Yes.
In the last season or two, has he been the most important player in our team? Yes, I would argue he is.
More so than Coleman, more so than Foster, more so than Van Dijk.
Yeah.
Nah.
No, they're better players. He's the most valuable player. There's a difference between the two.
No, I know where you're coming from, and I've had arguments before, and I just feel that we have he's an expensive. I was going to say luxury there. That's not the right phrase. He's just been, in terms of the expense that we've put out on him, I don't think we've got a return that I'd been looking for.
Yeah, well, but you see, that's why I would then say I've put his price to one side. Has he been, and a lot of the criticism that you and Jake were having and the argument about on Twitter, I would actually say what you were doing was describing the Scott Brown of 2+ years ago.
Mm.
Because for the first 2 years he was at Celtic, I felt he was poor distribution. And this is why the Barcelona thing for me was out of character. It was out of character of the way he's been in the last 12 to 18 months, probably 18 months to 24 months even, in that one of the things that used to bug me, I remember being taught at school, if there is a guy who fouls you badly and you gets away with it and you want to get him back, I remember being taught, it was under 14 level, because I remember the guy who told me it, I used to play in goal, so I wasn't even an outfield player, I just remember him telling the team, either get one of your colleagues to do him or wait 10 minutes to do him. But if a guy fouls you, gets away with it, and you foul him in the next 2 minutes, you'll get booked and he won't.
Mm-hmm.
And what used to bug me about Scott Brown was a guy would do something and Scott Brown would literally run around the park trying to kick the guy.
That's right. That's another criticism as well. He has to let that go. And constantly, he's not disciplined enough as a player. He's never been a disciplined player. And the other argument I have with Jake as well is, as I said, I don't dislike Scott Brown and I like him in the team. He adds something to the team, but he's never a central midfield player. He doesn't have the technique. He's not a great tackler and he's not a great passer. And in the middle of the park, that's what you need. So yes, if he plays in the right-hand side of four, that's where he's best, because he's sort of, dare I say, out the way a wee bit for the main part of the midfield. To let the players with better technique go into that position.
I would slightly disagree in terms of a modern 4-3-3. I think you need a bit of drive from the middle, and I think he
no, if it's 4-3-3, he's not in the middle, he's on the right.
But the overriding point is, I actually think he will suit, from what I can read. I mean, all of a sudden we're all experts on Ronnie Dyler's style of football.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've all managed to find the same three articles on the internet that describe the way he plays football. But from what I can read with the style of play he wants to do, I think Scott Brown will fit in with it. And in fact, one of my slight irritations with Lennon last season, you talking about the disappointments of last season, good things. The games that we played some of the best football in was when Lennon played 4-3-3.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the only games that we played badly, in fact, virtually the only games we lost were the only games that he changed the formation to this, you know, Hull Boy always has a go when I call it 4-2-4. I know it's not 4-2-4, but it ends up being played like 4-2-4.
Because you've got Forrest wide right and you've got Samaras wide
right. Left, yeah.
Yeah,
who, I know
what you mean.
Who play semi-advanced. And so actually you've just got two midfielders in the middle of the park and we're overrun and outnumbered. So we played that system against Aberdeen. We played that system far too many times in Europe.
The thing that really disappointed me, but while we're on the subject of the midfield, the thing that disappointed me last season is when Nir Beaton got injured. Because, see, at the time of his injury, he had come on to a right good game. And I thought, this guy, he's not a fancy player. He's not the kind of guy that you would go and watch and rave about. But I just felt that the half a dozen games before that, he had really begun to show what he can offer. And then he got that horrible injury playing for Israel, which was a really bad blow. And I just hope that he can recover. It'll not happen with, you know, what happened with Kyle. And Kyle never truly recovered from the injury to come back to the player that he was before that. So, but I think Nir Beaton next season, if he can carry forward the form that he showed, could be a real boost for us.
Yeah, I, like you, was liking Beatong. I think it was partly because Lennon had settled on this formation that was more or less 4-3-3. So once his better play was when we had a better midfield where Beatong wasn't one of two isolated people in the middle. And I think that's also the reason why what gave me great heart was Liam Henderson's play when he came into the team in the last 10 games or so of the season. Again, being able to slot into three men in the middle of the park. And the only disappointment for me is I always felt that system was the best to get got the best out of Joe Ledley. But
And then Joe's gone at that point.
the amount of times Joe Ledley played in the other silly system where he was sitting as a defensive holding player.
I was sorry to see Joe go for a number of reasons. I liked him as a player. He wasn't a showy guy either, but he was very consistent. He wasn't up or down. You got a level of consistency for Joe Ledley. And the other thing I liked is he had a habit of scoring important goals. But I have to say, I'm quite impressed with the boy Johansson. And I think it's good that he got a few months behind him to maybe let him know what size of club Celtic is. So that he can get used to it. But hopefully, as of the beginning of the season, he's another guy I think is going to be a big player for us, and I've got high hopes for him.
Hopefully he got on with his former manager.
No, that's the irony, isn't it? I mean, he goes there in January and his manager follows on in June. So, a wee bit like Martin O'Neill, maybe, and Neil Lennon. They know each other inside out, and Johansson will be able to tell the players what kind of guy the new manager's going to be and what kind of personality he is and what kind of football that he wants him to play. But that's a big opportunity for a few of the players at Celtic Park, maybe the guys who were on the fringes. But it'll also be interesting to see what do we do with Berichter, what do we do with Baldy, what do we do with Pukki, what do we do with Kyle and guys who maybe aren't playing and are unhappy. Do we give them another season under a new manager to see if they come to the fore, or do we just cut their losses and move them on?
Do you know, that's one of the things I've often wondered in that does, provided it is, I mean, we're assuming that it is, everything I'm hearing that is, it's Dyler, Ronnie Dyler, whatever he's, however you pronounce his name. If it is him, I always wonder in a situation like that, does he say to Celtic, right, okay, the players are back in 3 weeks' time. So, see between now and in 3 weeks' time, can you give me every single DVD that shows all the stats and all the information you've got on these players? Or is his attitude, well, that's all well and good, but they were playing under a different manager, under a different system, so I'm going to take a fresh look at them in pre-season and make my own decisions. I often wonder which way round it would be. I would like, if it was me, I would probably at least want, if I didn't know the players, at least want a better idea of getting to see something, but I'd also want to make my own judgments.
If you're going to be cynical, you can actually say that it suits the board to get a new manager because they can turn around and say, well, we're not going to sign any new players because he's going to take a few months to see what he's got here.
I don't think they would do that. I mean, if you want to be not cynical about it, if you want to be completely hard-nosed about it, there is absolutely no economic value whatsoever in Celtic spending a penny last summer or this summer in the transfer window.
Well, I think the economic value was Van Dijk. He signed a player
No,
for
what I mean by that is we could get, if we don't sign a single player,
It's all in the league.
we're still going to win the league. The squad that we've currently got will probably be the squad that tries to get us into the Champions League because in general, the type of players that we would want to sign to make us a better team for Champions League football will only come to us if they know we are playing Champions League football. So there is an argument of, well, we can only sign players who are no better than what we've already got prior to knowing we're in the Champions League. The current squad will win us the league. If the club were as bad, if the board were as bad as some people say they are, even if we qualify for the Champions League, we wouldn't sign a single player, because what's the point? because we've already got into the Champions League, so the money from, it's not like we're going to go and sign people who get us into the last eight or the last four.
No.
So we're not going to do that. So we might as well just put all the money in the bank, watch all the pennies rub up against the pounds in the bank account.
No, but you're forgetting one thing here. I think you're becoming very presumptuous that we're going to qualify for the Champions League. And from a personal point of view, I never ever take it for granted, because we've played five qualifiers in the last two seasons. And I'm going to leave out Cliftonville, with all due respect, because I don't think they're of a sufficient level that they're going to worry us. But when you think back to the Helsinki game, and you think back to the Elfsborg game last season, they were close to things. I remember watching that game in Helsinki, and up until we scored in the away leg, one goal was going to put us out of it, right up until about the 70th minute. And I remember watching it, I was a nervous wreck. And it's only when we scored the goal that I thought, no, they don't have enough quality now to come back and get two. Another one was Elfsborg. When we played Elfsborg in the second leg, we hardly had a shot and goal, and we actually defended very well, as it happened, uneasily for a Celtic team. Kelvin Wilson actually had a terrific game that night. But the point I'm making is that Elfsborg game could quite easily went against us, because we were dying on our feet at the end of the game. I think we were playing in a hot climate and we were playing in a plastic pitch. And I don't think we should ever disrespect that level of team that we're going to play in the Champions League. We can't take it for granted.
No, and I'm
going
not...
to sail through, is why the board have to invest in a reasonable class of player to ensure that we do get into the Champions League.
But my point was, the people that I read on Twitter often saying about the board penny pinching and the board don't do that. Well, if the board were like they were, if you put a complete hard-hearted business brain on, what you would do is not spend a penny, because we don't need to. And you wouldn't have done it last summer either. My point is, the type of player you want us to sign, from what people say and from about stuff, our biggest problem is the player I'd love us, you know, the most of us would like us to try and go out there and sign the next level of player, the player who is the... How the Gary Hooper two seasons after being with us, rather than Gary Hooper when we signed him, that level of player. That type of player won't come to us unless we're playing Champions League football.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my issues with the timing of things, and it's not just for us, it's not as if UEFA have got a thing for us. Last season, the signing deadline for us was 2 days after, we had 2 days after knowing we were in the Champions League to go out and try and sign those types of players.
Yeah, that's tremendously difficult. But the criticism, I understand and I take on board what you're saying, but the criticism I've got to the board is, we're quite willing to go out and pay 1.5, 2 million, 2.5 million for players. And hopefully you'll get a Van Dijk rather than a Berichter. Mm-hmm. However, I think we lack a wee bit of ambition from the point of view. Let's take Finn Bogson as an example last season. I don't think there's any secret that Celtic, that Lennon certainly would have loved to get his hands on Finn Bogson.
Yeah.
Now, he was going to cost £5.56 million if you believe the papers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think where the Celtic board fall down here is that is a big outlay for us. And I think we could afford that. I mean, Law will say as much himself. Yes, we could afford to go out and buy a £5 million, £6 million player. Now, I think that there lacks a wee bit of vision there, because you can sign a guy like Finn Bogson and he can play very well up here. He scored a lot of goals. Hopefully get a few goals in the Champions League. And see, before you know it, your £5 million outlay is worth 8 or 9, maybe even 10. So the
But what was he? What wages was he wanting?
Well, what I was going to say here was, you signed Baldy and Pookie, who contributed very little over the course of the season. You do have to say that. Now, I'm willing to bet that the wage that Baldy was getting and the wage that Pookie was getting, if you had them together, Finn Bogson would have been happy with that.
No, he wouldn't.
But coming to Holland?
Mm-hmm. To come to the northern backwater of Scotland? No, he wouldn't.
Well, he would have been getting a considerable increase in what he was getting in Herndon.
But he wasn't getting the 50, 60 grand. Those two salaries combined are not 60 grand.
I know, the point I'm making, though, is that rather than penny pinch, but no penny pinch, rather than go for the lower range players and they bought two of them, who'd, in fact, three if you include Berichter, that didn't work. If you'd have put all that money together and signed the one quality player that we really desired, it might have worked out better.
Yeah, but I'm sure they didn't sign Berichter and Baldy and Pookie thinking that they were going to fail.
And on the other hand as well, that there's no guarantee Finn Balkson would have came in and been a success.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is I think sometimes that the board lack that wee bit of ambition on that front.
I think I agree and disagree in that I can see where the problem comes if you go out and you sign Finn Balkson and put him on, say it's not, you know, somebody who told me that it was 50, 60 grand a week he was looking for. Say it was 40, which is 15 grand a week more than our highest salary of current players, as far as I understand it, and 20 grand a week more than what the sort of top is for the other people who are not people. Scott Brown. I think Scott Brown's on 25 and 20 is the cap for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And their argument is always, and I can get this, their argument is always, if you sign him on 40, that can cause a problem when everybody else is told they can't get more than 15 or 20. So it's not just him going to... the likelihood is, from what I've read in various places about the way players' contracts are in the 21st century, the likelihood is that probably if he signed at 40, Scott Brown's salary immediately goes to 40. And probably there's a whole raft of other players whose salaries all go up 10 grand. So signing one guy at 40 easily adds 200 grand a week onto your wage bill.
I don't believe for a minute that our board, or Peter Lobel, would sanction a contract that would have that in it.
Based on what I've read about modern football, if we weren't prepared to have those types of clauses, we wouldn't sign anybody in modern football. Contracts that say things like the captain is always... there is nobody paid higher than the captain, that type of contract. You know, I certainly remember reading when Stan Petrov signed his last contract at Celtic, it included a clause about him being on the same salary as the top paid player at Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the norm in football contracts, those types of clauses where you are, there'll be salary bands and you're always in an X band, you're always in Y percent of the top paid player and that type of deal.
I think I remember reading the story about Ian Wright when Bergkamp signed for Arsenal. And he tapped the door to Bruce Rioch's door when Bergkamp signed for Arsenal. And he basically just gave him a thumbs up, and that was the message that whatever Dennis Bergkamp was earning, and it would have been a big wad, Ian Wright had it in his contract, he was to get paid the same. But what I'm trying to say here is that I think we've got strong management at Celtic Park and the board. And I don't believe for a minute that they would sanction such a... No, in this league, I don't think anybody in the SPL in the current time has got the right to dictate, they should be on a par with anybody else. They should just be grateful for what they're getting.
But I suppose my point is, that's the type of clause that's been in football contracts now for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We can't...
Well, can you think for a minute that when Hendrick was in his pomp and he was at his peak, he would have been the best played player at Celtic. And uh-huh. I don't believe anybody else within the team would have grudged him that. So if you sign Finn Balkson and he rattles in 30, 40 goals a season, gets us into the Champions League qualifiers, scores a few goals in the qualifiers, and just an overnight sensation who becomes the most recognisable player in Scotland, then the other players don't have a right to go on and demand anything else.
No, they do if it's in their contract.
He is.
They do if it's in their contract. But if it's in their contract, they do.
Yeah, not at all. I honestly don't believe Lawwell would accept that.
Well, but the point I'm making is, if we don't do those types of contracts, we don't sign people from foreign countries.
Now, we're not getting high-profile players. That's okay if you're signing... If you're maybe at Man United and you want to sign Van Persie, and then Wayne Rooney goes in and says, whatever he's getting at, I need to get the same. Another thing as well is, look, you're a great believer in strong management, and you've always been a very pro-board. And I would say three quarters of the time I agree with you. But I think it's very weak management if you accept day contracts, because you're therefore being dictated to what you want to pay a player.
But those are But if that's the commercial norm within the industry, it's really difficult for you to negotiate a contract which doesn't have. If these, I don't know, but if these are the types of standard clauses that are industry wide, it's really difficult for you to be the only people within the industry who don't have those types of contracts. And then, of course, the other thing is, what if we signed Finn Bogson and he scored 11 goals? In the season.
And he's cost $5 million.
And he's cost $5 million and he's earning $45,000 a week.
Absolutely. That's what I said to you. There's no guarantees. All I'm saying is, I think for the outlay with Baldy and Tookie and Berichter, I think if they'd put all their eggs in the one basket, you might have got a better class of forward.
I agree. I would prefer us to sign, a bit like this, suppose you, what you're saying about your argument with Scott Brown. You're not saying, I'm not, to some extent, I'm playing the devil's advocate here in that I would like us to sign a Finn Bogson and sign people at that sort of money, because actually, if you then set a line and say wage cap's 20 million, purchase price cap is 2.5 million, the problem is football inflation's going at such an exorbitant rate that all you're doing is going backwards. I accept all of that, so don't get me wrong. My only point is, I'm quite sure they didn't say, well, do you know what? We can't sign Finn Bogson, but what we're going to do is we're going to sign three shite players instead. I'm sure they thought that they could get...
It's better value to get three rather than one.
Yes, it's better value, and I'm sure they thought, I'm picking numbers, but maybe they thought for 5 million quid and 45 grand a week, they might get 25 goals a season out of Finn Bogson, and for 2 million quid, and 20 grand a week, or 15 grand a week, or whatever the amount was, they might get 20 goals a season out of Pookie. And Finn Bogson might score 4 goals in Europe, and Pookie might score 3. Well, in the grand scheme of things, it's been a better, if that was the case, it's been a better deal to get Pookie. Might have been their thought process. Or it may well be more straightforward than that, that they just couldn't finalise a deal with Finn Bogson, and they were 24 hours away from the end of the transfer window for Europe and thought, right, okay, well, we can't afford to risk waiting on this guy for another 24 hours. We're going to have to go after our who's the next guy on the list after Finn Bogson? It's Pookie. It may well be that was the thought process.
Yeah, there's a guy in my work, and he's a Celtic fan, but he doesn't particularly go to many games these days. And he made a point to me, which I hadn't thought of, but I fully take on board what he's saying. He says, the current Celtic team is a good team. There's no standout players in it. Maybe argue Van Dijk's a standout, or Foster even. But I appreciate what he's saying. It's based on a team ethic. But he says, well, what the fans are crying out for is a personality player. They're crying out for a Larson, a Maravchik, a Decanio, a John Collins, a Paul McStay, somebody who is the focal point of the team. Now, when you look at Scott Brown, this isn't a criticism of Scott Brown, I'm just making a point here. Scott Brown is that kind of guy. And when you look at the team like Stokes and even Chris Commons, who I think is a fantastic player, they're no personality players. They don't have that wee extra, magic sort of aura that you sometimes get with players. And I always remember Tommy Burns, God rest him, is when Celtic were trying to sign Andy Tom. And there was a wee bit of debate at one point whether Tom was going to come or not, because Fergus wasn't convinced that Andy Tom would have been worth the money. And Tommy Burns says, I need somebody here who will get his bums on seats. Now, I'm looking about Celtic Park the last couple of seasons, and we could really do with a personality player, and that would bring an element of the support back to Parkhead, who we've lost over the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, Nakamura was the last maybe personality player that we had, or Arthur Boric. You know what I'm getting at? Players that the fans can associate with, players that the fans have that special relationship. And they don't have anybody of that ilk at the moment. And maybe Finn Bogson, in some small way, would have been that player. The goal scorer, the glamour guy, maybe he would have had a wee something to him, a wee spark that the fans would have taken to him. And he would have been that player. And for his outlay, and it would have been a considerable outlay, I mean, £5 million in Scottish terms is a huge amount of money. Some of those fans that we've lost may have come back, and you would have got some of your money back right away.
But it's all predicated. I understand the dilemma for the board when they've got loads of empty seats because people don't go. Now, I think it misunderstands the rationale of supporters. I actually understand that why there's empty seats, yet by all accounts we are actually ahead of where we were this time last year in season book renewals or in season book sales.
What kind of figure are we talking about, do you know?
I know that last season, I think we were at 42,000 season books at the end, once for the whole season, once we'd done it. I don't know how many are sold as you get closer to it and how many are sold once we qualify for the Champions League and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So all I know is that we are ahead of where we about. I think it's just a few thousand. I think we're probably roughly the same number of season books that Rangers have sold ahead of where we were last season. So I just know we're a wee bit ahead of where we were last season in season book sales. And, you know, but you're in an environment where we're the only team who've got a reduction in attendances. And I know what you're saying. So what you do is you go out and buy the star man and that puts bums on seats. I can also understand exactly the fear of the board is, what if you go out and buy the star man and all you do is stand still? You've just lost money.
Sorry, but what was that? If you buy the star man, what happens?
If you buy the star man, from your argument, it's guaranteed to put bums on seats and it pays for itself. Yeah. You would need to pay for itself. I'm trying to work it out off the top of my head. An extra 3 million, 5 million quid to buy the star man at roughly, what is it, £400 a season book now that they've knocked the 100 quid off, you need to sell 12,500 season books, more than we did. So you needed to have taken you needed the 42,000 season book sales to have gone up to 54,500 to have broken even on the £5 million purchase.
I'll tell you another anecdote.
Excluding these wages.
Yeah. I'll tell you another anecdote about Fergus. There was a time when the Celtic Park was getting rebuilt and remember, what is it called? The temporary stand behind the goal? So the capacity at that time, off the top of my head, was about 45,000 before the Celtic end was completed, the Jock Stein stand. And Celtic were after a player, and I'm racking my brains here, I can't even think who it is. And I know somebody who knew Fergus, and he asked Fergus about this player, and Fergus went like, no, we won't be signing him. And the guy said, oh, well, that's disappointing. And Fergus says, there's no need to sign him. And he says, well, why is that? He says, well, A, they've got a good squad, and B, there would be no financial gain in signing that guy because every seat we have is full. And I know what Fergus meant by that, and I think if Fergus was here now and he was in charge, he would look about the park at the empty seats and he would say to the manager and the scouts, get me a player who is going to fill those seats, or let's have a wee go at filling the seats. As you said there, every transfer has its uncertainties, and you can't be certain when you sign anyone that he's going to be a success. But Fergus was a showman. Fergus was a businessman, and he would have looked about and he would have said, get me somebody in here. Let's get a signing that will get everybody talking, that will get a lot of interest stimulated, and at least we'll have a wee go here at filling these seats.
The problem in modern football is how much that guy costs.
I know what you're saying, but you know, there comes a point that the board have got to say, we are making money each year, but we're bringing in a huge profit. And there comes a point you have to invest the money back in the team. And you have to take a wee gamble.
And they would say they did. The point would be because, I suppose you amortise it down over. If you sign a £5 million guy, he's on roughly 50 grand a week. That's £2.5 million. So just to pay his extra wages, you've got to generate an extra £2.5 million quid.
So but you already have that money there. That's the point. You're investing what you've already made.
Where have you already got it?
Well, the last two seasons have made big profits, and with the Champions League money swimming about and that kind of thing. They keep telling us at the EGMs that what a great balance sheet we've got and what a great profit we make.
We made a profit last year. The year before, we made a loss. We reduced our debt. So £2.5 million on a £50,000 a week salary is at £400 a season book. At 6,500 season books, you have to sell to pay salary. Then you got the transfer fee. You amortise it down over the lifetime of each contract. So if it's a 4-year contract, then it's actually only an extra £1 million onto his. It's only an extra £1 million onto those costs because you average it out over the lifetime of his contract. So one £4 million player earning £50,000 a week. If our average season book price is £400, you have to sell 8,750 season books extra on top of what you got to pay for him. So that's why I understand what the board's problem is. That they're looking at empty seats, and I want us to sign that type of player, but I also understand where why, getting back to my economics of we are getting 40,000 people and we're going to win the league, there is also an argument of at some point in the future Rangers come into, well, Rangers will eventually, a team called Rangers will eventually sort themselves out and be playing in the top league of Scottish football. So you make sure that we've not done anything silly with our finances during the time when there was no competition. So that whenever there is a team playing against us, if they've managed to sort themselves out and they manage to get some investors who put money into it, now that might be in 2 years' time, it might be in 5 years' time, whenever it is, that we're in a position that actually if they chuck money at it, so could we. That's what I would do if I was running the club. I'd actually be, to use the Scottish press's term, I would be saving up a war chest. Now that's not so easy to do. It's not as easy to do when you're a PLC because PLCs need, you know, there's dividends and things like that to do. But I would be doing that. I would be creating a war chest.
But what happens if the team called Rangers comes into the league and we still don't invest, and maybe the European results start to dry up and we don't qualify for the Champions League and we're in the Europa League and things get a wee bit apathetic and then you go up from 40,000 to 30,000.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that we don't spend any money. I'm just saying that that would be the thing for me that would make me stay prudent. And the other massive reason why I would stay prudent is go and ask anybody who runs any of the 42 clubs in Scotland and ask them where they can get credit. Because the big thing that nobody in the Scottish media have mentioned about the reprehensible way that Rangers have been allowed to walk away from debt. Has destroyed, you know, not that it's easy to get credit in the modern world anyway, but it has destroyed the ability for any football club in Scotland to get debt. Because why would you, if you were a lender, give debt in a business environment where it's accepted by the authorities that you can walk away from that debt and everybody will pretend you can walk away, not just in terms of administration and pay pence in the pound, you can walk away in terms of folding your business, start a Phoenix business and have everybody pretend that the Phoenix company is the same company as the one that had hundreds of millions of pounds of debt. Why would anybody lend money into that type of business environment? So that's the other thing that you're, the other reason why I would be, that would be weighing on my mind about prudent finances. I think we're too prudent. I always remember I had a lecturer at uni who used to go on about the reason why German business is successful is because an engineering firm in Germany will have an engineer running it and an accountant is his number two. And a major legal practice will have a lawyer running it, an accountant as a number two, and a construction firm will have a builder running it as accountant as a number two. And in Britain, we have, our companies are run by accountants who are number ones. Apologies to all accountants listening. I'm sure the ones listening are nice people. And Celtic are run by an accountant. I wouldn't have, nothing against Peter Lawwell, but I wouldn't have someone of Peter Lawwell's mentality as number one, I'd have him as a very strong number two.
I actually, I don't mind Lobo. I think overall he's been a steady hand in a till, and when you look at it, but I think what happened is that I can trace it back to Thomas Gravesen. We were still interested in what Lobo referred to as a blue chip signing up until that point, and Thomas Gravesen was an unmitigated disaster. He cost his money and he contributed nothing, apart from the first 6 weeks, where I thought we were going to build a team around him. And I thought he was going to be one of the best signings ever. And that's what I mean about that period. The stadium was full, or just about full. You know, the season tickets were 50,000 plus at that point, because guys like Gravesen were coming in, Nakamura, Arthur Boric, personality players, guys with a reputation, and we were happy to, you know, follow them on. But I can trace it back to Gravesen, where the attitude of the Celtic board changed. And maybe they were quite right, because as we were talking earlier on there, that if you gave me the chance of signing a guy who is working his way up, or the experienced pro who's working his way down, I'm going to take the guy who's working his way up. And the best example I can give you, that was Henrik. When Henrik came here, he had very little reputation. He was seen as an okay player. He played at a decent level with Feyenoord, but there was nothing at all to suggest that he was going to become the megastar that he turned out to be. Now, we couldn't have signed Henrik Larsson at his peak. There's no way they came here. He would have went to Spain or England or Germany or one of the big leagues. And that's why I don't mind Lobo's signing policy at the moment, up to a point where we try and get the gems like Van Dijk and Fraser Foster and Gary Hooper, and it's serving as well. But it just comes a point that you've got to say to the fans, if they are making money and we're trying to get you back here and we're trying to retain your interest, we will invest the money in the odd star name if we can get them.
But then, haven't you just answered your point in that Thomas Gravesen was exactly, and you, like me, when we signed Thomas Gravesen, thought, I can't believe they're doing this. This is fantastic.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a sensational signing.
Yeah. So doesn't he then illustrate the point that I've just made of, but what if you do that and it goes wrong?
If that's the case, you would never say anybody.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I'm partly playing devil's advocate here. I want us to sign better players. And I suppose what I'm doing is looking at the mindset of our board. That's why we don't, because that's their mindset. What if we do it and it goes wrong? It gets back to my point of, but that's why I would have people like that as number two, because then what they do is they temper and they caution on the enthusiastic, more showman type person. They temper them to rein them in, but you still get the odd high profile signing. So,
tell me this, something just sprung in my mind there, just if I can just bring it up. Do you think the new guy for Norway is going to be a head coach or a manager?
We'll call him a manager, but I think he'll be the head coach. I think we've more or less got a structure, and it's my criticism in that we need to be more explicit at just confirming that this is the case. We more or less have a structure of Peter Lawwell's the director of football, and we have a head coach that sits under him, which is the way that most of a large chunk of European football operates. And
yeah, it's maybe a wee return to the Wim Jansen, where Jock Brown sort of had the high profile post of general manager, and Wim Jansen was just expected to coach what he had.
I think that's what Lennon was. I think Lennon was the head coach, and Peter Law was the director of football under Lennon. And I'm certain you're saying about you like your signing strategy and players in general, bar you'd like us to have a slightly.
I would just like them to go a wee bit further on occasion. Just to show a wee bit of ambition occasionally.
But I think what you've described that you like us doing with the players, I think that's what we've now done with the manager as well. And as you say, you're picking someone who's on the way up, and I think what we are doing is, I think in the same way that our part of our signing pitch to players is, come to us and you've got a chance of exhibiting your skills in the Champions League. You're right next door to England. You've got a chance of a move to the biggest league in the world in terms of money. And you never know, you might also get a chance in Europe because you'll be strutting the stage of Champions League football. I'm sure that's our sales pitch to players to get them to Celtic. I think that's possibly been our sales pitch to Ronnie Dyla. Come to Celtic. We've got a better chance of getting Champions League football than you will in Norway. We've got a much bigger budget, better quality players, better standard of player. You make a success of yourself here, you've got a chance of bigger things elsewhere.
At the end of the day, to be blunt, it's a step up for him. And we're no naive. We know that if he comes here and we'll hope he's tremendously successful and he wins the treble next season and he gets us into the last 16 in Europe, then people are going to come hunting for south of the border. But that's... We've been... To be honest, my point that I always make is that one of the biggest problems of Scottish football is we share a border of England. And I think if we were an island in the middle of the North Sea, then I don't think we would have the same downer on their game as we have, as we sometimes do here. But there's no doubt that if he comes and he's successful and he's got an eye in England, then that's an opportunity for him.
Yeah, it's not just the fact that we're right next door to England, it's compounded by the fact that we share our, you know, this isn't a bit on independence or anything, but we share our media coverage because we share our language. So, you know, if you, even in Scandinavia, you know, at least the Norwegians and the Swedes and whatever have got different languages, that there's a bit of a differential between their economies. As you say, we are so much in the shadow of England that that's part of our problem of bringing people in. But then I suppose that's what we then use as a stepping stone of... you're right next door to England, so they'll see what you're up to. It's easier for them to come and scout you up in Celtic than it is elsewhere. Maybe that's what we do. But hoping that you'll be a success. Our problem, you're talking about Champions League qualifiers. One of our problems for the Champions League qualifiers is the first games, which should be we should be able to do it. We will be without our players who are at the World Cup.
The thing that worries me about the Champions League, and I was considering writing an article on the site about this, I'm very annoyed at the Celtic board for finding themselves in a situation that, not so much in the first qualifier, because again, with all due respect, it's going to be a team of a calibre who we should be able to beat regardless of where we play them. But the second qualifying round, is when you get maybe the Scandinavian teams who are a tough nut to crack at times, you're going to play one of the games at Murrayfield. And I don't know how we ended up in that situation. Because the greatest respect...
Because even if we haven't given Celtic Park over, we wouldn't have been allowed to play a Champions League game in Glasgow when the Commonwealth Games were on.
Says who?
Says Strathclyde, or Scottish Police Force, and the deal for Glasgow getting the Commonwealth Games.
You know... That's another thing how can I say it?
In the same way that when London got the Olympics, there was no major, part of the contract for London getting the Olympics, was no major sporting event was allowed to take place in London when the Olympics was on. So there could be no Premiership games, there could be no Champions League qualifiers when the Olympics were on. I think the same deal exists for the Commonwealth Games. So even if we'd not hosted the opening ceremony and got Glasgow City Council to pay for a massive upgrade of the surroundings around Celtic Park, we would not have been allowed to play a Champions League game at Celtic Park.
I'll put it to you like this. If we play that second game, that second qualifier, and we don't get through it, and I think I'm right in saying that that means you don't even get the Europa League. So there'll be no European football. It doesn't matter how good your surroundings are at Celtic Park, they'll be absolute... revolt around Celtic Park.
But what was our option?
Well, I don't understand why we can't play a game when the Commonwealth Games is on.
Because that's part of that's just the rules. You can't have a major event on at the same time that the Commonwealth Games are on.
Is this coming through the police?
It's the whole kit and caboodle of what Glasgow's pitch was. It will have sole media focus. So there'll be no other major Glasgow events in Glasgow.
Pitch and put Celtic to the side.
That was what they did 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Celtic might not. I'm sure Champions League qualifiers didn't come into it. So, and the police would just say, well, we can't go and resource our. You know, look at this, put it this way, the police can't cope with two major, I know they used to 40, 50 years ago, but the police now can't cope with two major events on at the same time in Glasgow. You can't have Celtic and Rangers playing at either end of Glasgow on the same day. That just can't happen. So Celtic, the police would have just turned around and said, well, we'll not police the game, so Celtic wouldn't have got a safety certificate to have the game on in Glasgow anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an element of the opening ceremonies at Celtic Park because, well, Celtic wouldn't have been able to use it anyway, so they might as well get the benefit of it rather than it sitting lying empty and we go and play in Murrayfield anyway.
No, so I'm aboard in Brigg last week, you know, and there's nobody more prouder than me getting a Commonwealth Games, and we all hope it's going to be a great success. But again, all I'm saying is, if you don't qualify for this Champions League and you go in the second round at Murrayfield, then, you know, it's going to get pretty ugly.
But it's not Celtic's fault.
Right, okay, it may all be Celtic's fault, but it's still going to get ugly.
I know it's not your fault, but it's your fault. So I would argue.
And it worries me greatly. I'm serious. I'm very concerned about it because I think playing in Murrayfield and a stadium that we've never played in and a surrounding that we've never played in, we don't even know what the surface is going to be like because they're still relaying it. Another thing as well is how many fans are going to go to Edinburgh? Is there going to be any financial recompense for the supporters who are at a pocket?
Well, I know that Celtic are in conversation with ScotRail and First Bus. Celtic have looked at the kick-off time. A lot of these things are difficult for Celtic in that they can't have the kick-off time too early because Glaswegians can't get through to Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. But they can't have kick-off times too late because then it'll be difficult to get back through from Edinburgh mm-hmm. to Glasgow. So I believe they're looking at trying to do it around about 8 o'clock to 8:30 in that time mm-hmm. span for a kick-off time. they've been in discussions with ScotRail. We may be able to get a tram. They've been in discussions with ScotRail and First Bus about travel to and from the stadium. To be fair, that game falls in the middle of the Glasgow Fair. Even if it was at Celtic Park, I would not be expecting a crowd of more than sort of mid-30s to maximum 40,000.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in terms of the moving it to Murrayfield, who knows? You may get 25,000 people there. You may get people turning up because they've got the novelty of going to a football game at Murrayfield. So you might get 10,000 people who wouldn't have gone at Celtic Park because we're playing a bunch of nobodies who might go to Murrayfield because, hey, we're getting a game of football at Murrayfield. My point would be more, if we get beat at that stage, we deserve to get beat. Because the team that we are playing should be, we are much better than the quality of team that we'll be playing at that round.
I'm talking about the second round, not the first round.
Uh-huh.
The second round, we are not that much better. And that's why I was trying to reiterate earlier on there about Helsinki and Elfsborg. And the other thing is the draw has been kind to us the last couple of years. And you know, you may end up with a Kiev, you may end up with a Wisla Krakow, you may end up with teams of that calibre. And that will be a big ask for us. Especially if you need to play it in a neutral venue.
But as I say, we've got no real option over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Celtic's fault. All Celtic have done is, under the circumstances of our ground to be out of commission anyway, we've lobbed ourselves in so that we then get a fantastic financial benefit out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we've done.
Yeah. That's my point. That'll be a wee bit hollow if there isn't any Champions League football next season and we're not in Europe. Try explaining that to the supporters. Well, you've got a nice new Celtic way there.
Yeah, but...
But by the way, boys, there isn't any European football.
Yeah, well, the other way of putting it is, well, boys, we get knocked out of Europe because we're not good enough. We played at Murrayfield because we couldn't play in Glasgow and we chucked our rattle out of the pram and wouldn't let anybody use Celtic Park. So Celtic Park lay empty. We played at Murrayfield and we still get beat.
I don't know. I think that the Celtic Park thing is a restriction of trade. And the more you're explaining this to me, the more I'm thinking, well, that's like saying, you know, like you say to Marks and Spencers, you can't open because, you know, we've got this big thing in Argyle Street. They've got this big street fair coming up, or an Orange Walk or something like that, and they need to shut Marks and Spencers. Marks and Spencers would say, no, why should we? We're here every week.
Yeah, but if Marks and Spencers then said, we need to get a certificate to be allowed to play, a safety certificate to be allowed to open every day, and we need X number of police, and the police say, well, we don't have the resources to come to you because we've already committed, 7 years ago, we committed our resources to this event.
Mm-hmm.
So your options, Marks and Spencers, are don't open or don't open.
Mm-hmm.
You've known about this coming for 7 years. You could have made alternative arrangements to have a temporary shop open further down Argyle Street.
Mm-hmm.
Celtic are not being told they can't play. They're just being told that they can't play in Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. Well, all I'm saying is, and I've felt this way for a long while, is I am deeply concerned that this may not go well. It's got everything, strikes me, has been everything that could be a disaster. And as I said, the fans will not listen to any reasonable excuses if they don't qualify on the grounds that we get beat in Murrayfield.
I think the majority of people would understand. Your point, I've known for years that we wouldn't be playing. I was actually surprised when the press made a big deal of it a year ago, because I've known for a couple of years that we wouldn't be playing at Celtic Park for the Champions League qualifiers. So for me, the bigger deal was, getting back to the change of manager thing, for me, the bigger deal was, If we knew there was a good chance, I mean, I made this point on Twitter, and somebody misunderstood that I was sort of had some in the know about changing manager or something that was on the horizon. When Lennon went, I said, in view of all the circumstances, a change just now is not the end of the world. And somebody thought I was having a go at Lennon. I wasn't meaning that. What I was meaning was, if Neil Lennon and Celtic were coming to a point where Lennon felt a change would do him good, and the Celtic board were of a mindset of that sometime in the next year or two, a change would do Celtic good, and Neil Lennon was thinking, yeah, 4 or 5 years as manager of Celtic's good enough. I felt this was the right summer to change the manager.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as we've just talked about signing a high-profile player and what if it doesn't work out, as was demonstrated with Tony Mowbray, you can go and get a manager and think that he's going to be the bee's knees, and then he fails. And my attitude was, the likelihood is, despite all this stuff we do laughing at Rangers, it's still highly likely that Rangers will come out of the Championship next season and get into the top flight. And what I really didn't want was for us to change our manager the summer that Rangers come into the top flight, just in case they get themselves sorted a bit and they actually manage, they get rid of McCoystin, they get a half-decent manager, and they actually find some investors who genuinely do put money into the team, and they spend a wee bit of money, and they become good enough to be a top-six Premier League team. My concern was, if we changed manager next summer and we ended up making a mess of it, we've talked about, from what we've read, Ronnie Dyler looks like he's going to be great. But he might not. He might be another Tony Mowbray. He might be another John Barnes, and he might be another Paul Le Guin for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing I would say is,
and I just didn't want that, the season that Rangers are back in the SPL, and suddenly, Rangers are in the SPL, I should say, because suddenly you get momentum behind results, and you can easily, particularly with Celtic and the two biggest teams in Glasgow, you can easily get positive momentum by the media and everybody behind one, and negative momentum by the other, and you can have a quick downward spiral. So that was what I meant when I put on Twitter about, if Lennon thought that there was a good chance he was going to leave in the next year or two, I would prefer him to leave before Rangers come back in, so that the new manager, and hopefully this guy is a success, the new manager's then got a year to really get to start to build his team, and then his second season can be even better.
You mentioned something there, that Paul Le Guin, obviously when he went to Rangers, that was a huge change, a shift from them, for the point of view that they were bringing in a continental to the place. McLeish.
Aye.
But the thing I hope that we do is I hope we get this guy time. Now, obviously, if you know, please God that he's not going to be an unmitigated disaster. But you know, if things are a wee bit rough at the beginning, and you know, sometimes you've got to. I mean, look at Lennon, for example. He was a year and a half in the job, and we went to Rugby Park that day, and we were 3-0 down at half time.
Yeah.
We've been through a right rough patch then, but we stuck with it and we came out the other side. And sometimes you've got to show a bit of determination. You can't go just. But then on the other side, then you've got the Tony Mowbray situation. That you're 8 months there, and then one night you get beat 4-0 with St. Mirren, and you're at a job. So.
Yeah, and the other thing, the sort of counter to changing the manager this season is I actually felt your point earlier about the Champions League being a bit a disappointment last season. I felt that because we changed two or three of Lennon's key players in that, Lennon liked Kelvin Wilson. He stated afterwards in interviews last season that he signed Van Dijk to play alongside Kelvin Wilson. So he lost Kelvin Wilson, he lost Victor Wanyama and Gary Hooper. So the sort of three mainstays of his team went. I actually felt it, that part of our problem last season is I didn't feel as though it was until about December that Lennon really knew who his best team was after the changes. And what I was looking forward to next season was, okay, there's a possibility we might lose Van Dijk or Foster.
Or both. Mm-hmm.
But I just felt that was more manageable than the best striker, the best midfielder, and then the manager's head, the best defender.
Mm-hmm.
And so my only disappointment with Lennon going is I genuinely thought our performances in Europe next season would be better than the season just passed.
Yeah, I think you were right. But then again, I think that part of the frustration that Lennon felt, and maybe one of the reasons that he left, was season after season he was going to need to replace his better players. And last year, Wanyama left, Hooper left, Kelvin Wilson left, and this year we're bracing ourselves for losing Foster and Van Dijk. And I think that's maybe made his mind up to say, well, you know something, I'm fed up with this.
And that's and I think that's another reason why we might have if you look at modern football, actually, at the very top level, excluding us for a moment, there's a sort of a merry-go-round of the very top coaches, and the clubs are fairly static. Of players the most expensive players coming in and out, and they give themselves a wee edge by moving. You know, look at Ancelotti,
mm-hmm.
moving round the top fringes of clubs. By all accounts, I read somewhere that actually Alex Ferguson wanted Ancelotti ahead of Moyes.
Mm-hmm.
But that culture now that, you know, the average lifespan of a manager in England's only 18 months, I think the culture of being at a club, we have to accept the Celtic manager's likely to be there for no more than 3 to 5 years. And I think one of the things that will make it tiring to be Celtic manager is you will have to create a new team within that 3 to 5 years that they're there, and you might even have to make two new teams. So the longer you're there, the more it then becomes tiring of your point of you're going to lose your three best players every 18 months to 2 years, and you have to try and find replacements who aren't as good when you sign them. And that's a tiring thing to do.
We're no unique to that either, because even like a Man United lost Ronaldo, and there's talk about Man City this season that they might lose Yaya Toure and Aguero. So, I mean, even at the big teams, they can still be prone to losing their better players, but they just need to make do it.
Yeah. So, we're going to lose some players, and you've talked about you'd like us to not buy in another Bo Richter, Bobo Baldi, Timo Pukki, and you'd like us to maybe get a slightly better standard of player. So what are the players, not the players, because I don't expect you to have a whole list of people that you've been scouting for the last few hours. Who are the, what's the positions that you'd like us to get over the summer?
It's difficult to say because, I mean, if they do lose Foster and they do lose Van Dijk, then in many ways they might be irreplaceable because it's hard to see us getting a similar type of quality unless we're extremely lucky. I think what we could be looking for is, we were speaking about the personality player earlier on, I would like to see us get somebody, a number 10, who can play a bit in the hole behind the strikers. You know, like a playmaker, a guy who can, maybe a free kick taker and somebody who can fire shots in the edge of the area.
Yeah.
I actually think Chris Commons fulfills that role very well for us in our environment.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel that when we get into Europe, Commons is a wee bit short of what we maybe hoped for. And I love Chris Commons as a player. I think he's been a wonderful signing. And he's a kind of player that I love to watch. Another thing I really admire about Chris Commons as well is sometimes we try and work the ball into the net to score the perfect goal.
Yeah.
And there's times he gets the ball and there's only one thing he's interested in shooting. It doesn't matter how mad the angle is or how far out he is. And that's not a bad thing because if you don't shoot, you don't score.
So, no, in fact, it's one of these sort of things where sometimes in a game you can be sitting thinking, you don't have to shoot every time. And then the next time he gets the ball after you've just thought that, he puts the ball in the back of the net and you think, well, I suppose that's the benefit of it. But yeah, one of my frustrations is we don't shoot enough from distance.
No, we don't. And it used to be something we were famous for. You know, like guys like Murdoch McLeod, Ronnie Glavin, and Collins and McStay could all crack a ball for distance. And we seem to have lost that ability to do that. But the other thing as well is I would like to see you get a stronger forward. I'd like to see somebody who could hold a ball up. You know, obviously, you would think back to the days of Harps and Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see for a minute we're going to get that kind of quality. But I like Venegar Hessel. I thought he was a good player for us. And he sort of filled the role that we needed at that time. And the other thing is it gives you an option as well. I mean, there's Liverpool where they're signing Ricky Lambert. And you would think that Ricky Lambert doesn't really fit in with Liverpool philosophy that Brendan Rodgers is trying to have. But
mm-hmm.
I think Rodgers is realistic to know that, you know, there's times maybe in the last 20 minutes when you need a goal, that you need a presence up front that you can maybe hit early rather than play football in your normal manner. And I think we like that as well. I know Amido Ball, they sort of fitted the build, didn't he? He was a big, strong guy.
Yeah.
He was fairly fast. But, you know, I think he's, without being unkind, he's nowhere near the level of even the SPL.
No.
Although, I think he's an experiment that didn't go to plan. And
no.
Although, if he moves on.
You know, I suppose, as one of our mates often uses the phrase, when you've got our signing strategy, you're going to kiss a few frogs.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think the thing that disappointed me about Bogey the most was, I wasn't expecting him to be a perfect goal scorer in particular. But I was just hoping he'd have been one of the guys that would have been strong enough to hold the ball, to get support up to him. And even in the area, he didn't, for a big man, he didn't look particularly impressive in there. It was a strange one. So.
Yeah, but then I also remember guy next to me bemoaning in Van Hooydonk's first season that you'd struggle to slip a bookie to get a bookie slip underneath mm-hmm. his studs when he went for a header. So
that's right.
I suppose just because he's a big, tall guy doesn't mean he's going to be good in the air. Well,
no, but I think Van Hooydonk had a technique and he'd a wee bit of natural ability, which I don't think, looking at Baldy, I certainly can't see anything in him. Sometimes you see a player and you think, well, I'm not sure about him, but, you know, he's faster, I'm not sure about him, but he's good in the air, but I just can't see anything in him. There's actually a friend of mine who...
He's got a better goal-scoring record than Daryl Murphy.
Well, that's damned by faint praise, right? There's a friend of mine, he went on tour with the club last season when they played the pre-season games. And he made two forecasts, and the first forecast was that this guy, Baldy, wasn't good enough. Nowhere near good enough was the way he described it. And the second thing is that Van Dijk would be a sensation. So he was right in both counts.
Aye. Anyway, that's quite a long bit of the podcast. I'll get that up and running soon. However, obviously, if there's news breaks before I manage to get it up that something disastrous has happened, I understand we've agreed terms with Ronnie Dyler. We believe we can reach compensation with his club. However, should some spanner arrive in the works, I'll obviously delete this podcast and no one will ever hear it.
I need a collector's item.
Yeah, exactly. It'll join the lost podcasts mm-hmm. of every time Eddie did one like that that filled with stuff that never come out. So enough to say, I hope you're well, St. Anthony, and I'll speak soon.
No bother. Thanks very much, Harry.
Okay,
bye.
Cheers, bye. I hope you enjoyed that. There'll be another podcast long soon. Hopefully the new manager is going to be fantastic. And best of luck to whatever happens in Neil Lennon's career. But for this podcast, this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight. Goodnight. With a smile, knowing all the time that his lies are mine. He's Mr. Know-it-all. Must be seen. There's no doubt, he's the coolest one with the biggest mouth. He's Mr. Know-it-all. When you tell him he's living fast, he will say, what do you know? If you had my kind of cash, you'd have more than one place to go. It's how much you pay. He's Mr. Know-it-all. If he shakes on a bed, he's the kind of dude that won't pay his debt. Oh, he's Mr. Know-it-all. When you say that he's living wrong, tell you he knows he's living right, and you'd be a stronger man if you took Mr. Know-it-all's advice. Oh, he's the man with the plan, got the counterfeit dollar in his hand. Word.